It's open. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Wa Salli Wa Sallam Ala Sayyid Al Awaleen Wal Akhirin, Nabiyyana Muhammadin, Wa Ala Alihi Wa Sahbihi Ajmain, Wa Ba'd. All praise are due to Allah, Lord of the Worlds, and peace and blessings be constantly showered upon our beloved Prophet Muhammad, the Master of the First and the Last, his family, his companions, and all those who call to his way and establish his Sunnah to the Day of Judgment. As to what follows, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah, we are continuing on in our study of minarets and thrones. And this topic, the topic of leadership in Islam, is, I believe, one of the most significant topics that Muslims should be seriously looking at, especially people who are thinking about the day after. When we look at the crisis going on now in the Middle East and many parts of the world, people naturally are caught up with the events of today. But what is frightening for a lot of people is that there's no plan for the day after. What happens after the great battles? What happens after the great destruction? And this is where Allah Azza wa Jal has given us the ability to reflect and also given us a long history that has gone through cycles. There are cycles when the Muslims are in a strong position, and this is what Ibn Khaldun, the great historian, looked at as the cycle of leadership in Islam and society. And that is when Muslims live up to our morals and our way of life, then we are in the top of the circle. But as we get weak and move away from our principles, then we start to go down. And this cycle has gone on over and over again in the history of Islam in different parts of the world. And so what kept the Muslims going is the fact that we were blessed with an eternal scripture. We are blessed with a living Quran that was not destroyed. We are also blessed with a preserved Sunnah of our Messenger, which was not destroyed. So that even though it appeared the societies were falling apart, they were able to return to the strength that they had in previous generations. and which direction are we going in? Now, there are different dynamics between leaders and rulers. Okay, sometimes the rulers and the leaders can work together. Sometimes they're enemies. And in some rare cases, and this is how it was in the beginning of the Islamic period, there's a fusion. So there's a fusion amongst the leaders where you get a person who is designated as the ruler or the leader of the Muslim world. And at the same time, he's a scholar. So you got both. And that is ideal because that is the prophetic leadership. That's the one that we want. It isn't always the case. It's rare. But it's something that we should push towards. It's like a holistic, well-rounded kind of leader. And so this leader then has got profound understanding of Islamic knowledge, is a moral person, and at the same time, they understand Islamic governance. They know how to rule according to the Islamic way of life. Okay, so this is the fusion. And we want to look at a few examples of this fusion given to us by Allah as a blessing in the period of the Khulafa al-Rashidin that was designated by the Prophet ﷺ as being 30 years. So within this 30-year period, you will see the ideal type of leaders that we hope for and pray for in the Muslim world. The second of the two, the first was Abu Bakr as-Siddiq radiallahu anh, and the second was Umar bin Khattab radiallahu anh. And I would say that Umar really represents the pinnacle. He is probably the best example, in my opinion, and Allah knows best, but he is the best example of this fusion. What he was able to accomplish is an example for leaders throughout time. And Umar, radiallahu anhu, he was born in 584 AD or CE in Mecca. And he was part of Quraysh. So he wasn't Hashim, the Hashimites, like the Prophet ﷺ. He was not Umayyad, from the Banu Umayyah side, but he was from the Banu Adi. So this is another clan within the Quraysh. And from the early part of his life, he was known to be a person who was very strong physically. So he was a person who was, it appears, somewhere around 6 feet tall, maybe a little less. And that amongst the Arab populations is very tall, because people do not tend to be 6 feet and above. But he was very strong. And he was described as being ambidextrous, which means he is equally strong with his right hand and his left hand. Okay, most of us are called what we call righties. We do things on the right or we sort of left. But there are some people who are equal both ways. That means that he has an advantage, especially in physical fighting, also in thinking. Because left-handed people, right-handed people even have sort of a way of approaching things. So he's both. He's flexible. And he also had this ability, strong ability in Arabic language, very eloquent. He was a natural leader. So even before the prophethood of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he was known in Quraysh as one of the upcoming leaders. Okay, so he had this maqam or this position in Mecca itself. And some of his other good qualities is that he was highly disciplined, highly organized and highly disciplined. And he had a sense of justice. So even though it's times of ignorance, he believed in justice. And when he saw things going wrong, things that were not just, then he naturally moved against that. So he had this nature about him. And as we learn from our traditions, that the best of you in Jahiliya, the best of you in ignorance, or before you practice Islam, they can be the best in Islam. Because when you become Muslim, you carry qualities with you. So whatever were your qualities before, you're going to carry them into your Islam. And so, before his Islam, again, he very strong personality. So therefore, when there was opposition to his society, he stood against this because he thought that this opposition was wrong. And any time he sensed injustice, he would oppose it. And he was not one who was necessarily afraid to face strong forces that were against him. And the way the society was set up, they did not have any restrictions in terms of alcoholism, in terms of their basic social life. And on one occasion, it is reported that he actually went down to the Kaaba area. The Nadi was there, the men's club, and they used to drink alcohol there and gamble and go to the idols. They used to do many different things. And so on one occasion, he was there, and this mention of this man teaching the belief in one God came. The shaitan came to Umar, and he felt that he needed to kill this man. So this burning, raging flame came up inside of him, and he headed towards what he thought would be the area where Umar was living. But while he was in the area, somebody told him that if you're looking for the Prophet, you better go to your own family, because your sister, Fatima, bint al-Khattab, radiallahu anha, she's Muslim. And so he went to her home and found her and her husband there. And they were reading something from the Quran. And Umar, in his rage, grabbed his sister and hit her in her face, and blood started coming down. He had some shame. And so he stopped. And he asked, "What is this thing that you're reading?" And she said, "If you want to know, you better clean yourself first." So he went and he washed up, came out of his rage, and he listened. And it is reported that they read from Surah Taha. This is the 20th chapter, verses 1 to 8. And this immediately had an impact on Umar. It's a spiritual thing because Allah guides whom He pleases. But you can see it with Umar because he was fasih. He was a strong Arabic speaker. And the Quran has the ability, especially for somebody who can speak Arabic. And this is something special for those who can speak Arabic. It's got abilities for everybody, but it's something special in that language because the Quran has i'jaz. It is miraculous because how the sentences go cannot be produced. It cannot be produced because in Arabic you have poetry, which has certain rhythm to it, and you also have prose, where you're telling a story. But the Quran is rhymed prose. So it's like telling a story in complete rhythm. And people cannot tell stories with rhythm. So everything is actually equal. That's impossible. You would sound like a mad person. Like today amongst the youth, this hip-hop, the rappers, in all language, they're rapping and they're trying to do things equally. But when you listen to what they're saying, most of it is foolishness. Because you can't continue to rhyme things. for the Muslims. And immediately, Omar transformed, because this is the kind of person that he is. He's an action-oriented person. So he immediately transformed, and he became one of the trusted companions, one of the close companions, because he would assume immediately a security position. Once they were sure that he was practicing his Islam, okay, and he's not trying to play a trick, he was put into a security position. So right away, they were able to start coming out a little bit. And shortly after, when Hamza Abdul Muttalib accepted Islam, then Umar and Hamza would move together in front, and the Muslims would go to the Kaaba itself, and they could pray and return. Because those two people in security would intimidate most of the opposition. So Umar then, he was in a key role. And you see his position right from there in the Meccan period, in the migration. And when Umar was ready to migrate from Mecca to Medina, he didn't go underground like most of the people had were forced to go. He went to the Quraysh and he said, I'm migrating tomorrow morning. Anybody who doesn't want me to, meet me there. So he challenged them. Of course, nobody came to deal with him. That's the kind of personality that this individual had. And it is said, the Prophet ﷺ said that, you know, everybody has a qareen. All of us have a type of jinni that is around us. And it's whispering at us. Also, there are jinn, evil demons, who will be in certain deserted areas and certain places. And the Prophet ﷺ said when people would go down certain alleys, the shaitan would be there. There would be an evil force there. But when Umar went down the alley, the shaitan would run, would not stand, not be in that alley, even though the jinn is not visible. But Umar is so powerful on a physical level and a spiritual level that the jinni was afraid to be in the same alley as Umar radiallahu anhu. And so he continued in this strong position. He was the right-hand man of Abu Bakr. Remember, Abu Bakr was faced with the ridda, with apostates, people breaking away and not paying zakat. Umar was even a little bit reluctant to go against those tribes, but Abu Bakr was strong. And when Abu Bakr was finally, after those 2 years plus in his leadership, was on his deathbed, he chose Umar to be his successor. Okay, so this is one of the ways that Muslims choose their leadership. So he chose Umar to be his successor, and he had to be ratified by the Muslims. So it's not a dictatorship. It's a selection. So you either have the leader himself or you have a selection committee, and they field names and whatnot of the most suitable person for leadership. And then this is, they choose and they take it to the people. And if the people ratify this, then that person becomes the leader of the Muslims. And Umar radiallahu anhu, his leadership lasted for 10 years. And this is a powerful leadership. And during his time, some major things happened. Muslims were attacked by the Romans from the north. And Umar in leadership responded to them. The Persians attacked from the east. Umar in leadership responded to them. This is no small thing. This is major. Like you see what's happening today, major powers attacking the Muslims. And these powers would come into battle with 100,000 men, fully armed. Okay, out, which seems to be irresistible force. But the Muslim, the level that they were practicing their Islam and the will of Allah Azza wa Jal meant that even this small group, that this group could defeat a larger group with the permission of Allah. So Umar did a lot of things. Cities like Jerusalem, Damascus, Al-Fustat, which later became Al-Qahira, Egypt, they came into Islam, some of them with war, some of them with peace. They came into Islam. And Umar, as we will see, he developed a state. So he now developed foundations, right? Judiciary. So many things, as we will see, are what it is. Okay? So now, again, looking at this leader, what is this is like an ideal person to take over. And if we see young people like this, then we need to have leadership training. So there needs to be leadership academies that are set up where male and female are in these academies and they are being trained to take over the leadership. This is crucial. This will help us for the future. What are some of the qualities? He was known for austerity. He did not spend a lot of wealth on himself. He lived a simple life. And he was extremely empathetic for the poor. So it's not just you feel sympathy, but you relate to them. So he cared for the welfare of the Muslim community. Okay, and he himself, although he's got such strength, he's got qualities, he's Quraysh, he's taller than just about everybody, but he's a humble person. Like he'll listen to other people, even those who are smaller than him, and he had this concern. To the point where it is reported during his leadership, on many occasions when people were sleeping, Umar would walk the streets and he would literally listen and see if there were people who were in need. That's the leader. Not our leaders today who are stuck in bunkers or in a royal palace. I lived in one country, I won't say which one it is, and you know, when the leader was going to go from his palace to his office, 2 hours before, the police are lining the streets. So we're moving through, just going to school or doing. Why are the police all along the street? And then suddenly, this car flies through because he's going from his palace to his office. What are you afraid of? And in those days, there were no drones. So it's not like you had a drone above you that might shoot you down like today, right? Today I can understand. There's no drones, man, in those days. What are you afraid of? They're afraid of their own people. Umar was not like that. And it is said that when the leader of the Christians in Jerusalem wanted Umar to come to accept the key to the city, and they came to Medina and they said, "Where's Umar?" And they said, "Look over there on the palm tree, the date palm tree. He was under there. He had his turban on a rock and he was sleeping." Okay, he said, "That's the Khalifa?" And he said, "That's the Khalifa. He rests because he's not afraid of the people. You see, he's a regular person." Okay, so this is very important qualities for the leadership that we need. So along with these personal qualities, and this again, we're talking about leadership. Part of leadership is innate. It's in you. Some people are leaders. Some people are just not leaders. They can hardly even tell their brother and sister. They can hardly tell a baby what to do. But other people are natural leaders. And that is important. Okay? But also what we're talking about is not just natural leader, we're talking about scholarship. Okay, we're talking about ilm. And so Umar was actually a great scholar of Islam, especially in what is now known as al-fiqh, Islamic jurisprudence. So if you would try to like categorize people, today they say he's good in hadith, he's good in tafsir, he's good in Arabic, he was good in fiqh. Right, that is jurisprudence, and then also practically applying the laws of Islam to society. Okay, al-fiqh al-waqi'a, right? Putting it into practice, relevant, alive fiqh. Okay, so this is where, you know, he was as a great leader. And so therefore, he was there from the beginning. And he's really good in Arabic, and he's listening to the revelation. So all of those subjects, when we talked about scholarship in the beginning, that you need to know Arabic language, you need to be good, you know, good in literature, you need to know hadith, you need to know tafsir, right? All these subjects that you need to study to be a scholar, in those days, it was a natural thing. For those who were close to the Prophet ﷺ, they were like taking in everything. And Umar was one of those people who was taking in knowledge rapidly. And so along with this, he's got piety. He's implementing his Islam. And he has this type of like wisdom. He's got wisdom. And so because of this, he's able to now confront issues. And this is one of the things we're talking about now in governance. Because you have to confront real live issues. Okay? So in looking at this, his ability to apply the law, to understand issues, he would be what we call today mujtahid. Okay, so these are all qualities. You'll see people who will go to Islamic universities and this person becomes a sheikh or he becomes maulana in some schools they call him. And then the person becomes like a mufti. And then they say this is allama, different levels. But one of the highest levels in terms of Islamic knowledge is what is called a mujtahid. And a mujtahid then is a person in fiqh, juristic fiqh, who is capable of independent legal reasoning. Independent. So he understands the rulings so much so, and he understands the society so much that he can actually make decisions about issues that were not known before. So some new issue comes now. What are we supposed to do with this? And this is hitting Muslims up until today because artificial insemination. What if there's a husband and a wife and they cannot have a normal relationship and there is artificial insemination, right? Where sperm is placed into the egg artificially. Okay, what's the decision? Think about this. And this was not known by scholars before because we did not have science to do this. And so big fiqh committees, just to give you an idea, came together that had these type of people, mujtahid, and they allowed it in the case that husband and wife, that the sperm that comes together with the egg has to be his and has to be hers. Because that's husband and wife. So this surrogate, having another person, you know, who does it, another person's egg or the woman, that would not be acceptable. You see, so that's ijtihad. So they allow it to happen, okay, because they have the ability to do this. That's how Umar was. So he was able to deal with the issues in the evolution of the Muslim society, dealing with the welfare of the people. And one of the strong points, sometimes the one that they even give him this title for, is justice. It is justice. And this, I believe, is, you know, along with your piety and your belief in one God, you know, justice is one of the most important qualities of a Muslim deer. And really, if you go to the Muslim world, and I had the opportunity to travel in many Muslim countries, okay, and actually be there and meet the people from there. And what I noticed in many of the Muslim, so-called Muslim countries that were ruled by these people trained in the West, or these tyrants and dictators, there's no justice. If you're not in the ruling tribe, There's no justice for you. You have a child that's born in the country and they say, you can't get citizenship. Where did you get this from? Like, there's no justice in the society. The people who are in the leading tribes get justice and other people don't. That's tribalism. So therefore, if there's no justice in the Muslim world, we cannot expect to have victory. And that is the reason why many Muslims actually went to some of the Western countries. Because in some of the Western countries, on a lower level, I'm talking about personal law, you could at least have a semblance of justice, where you would go to a court, you have a case, and you get a lawyer, and you go to a court, and you can actually battle, you know, for your case, and in some cases, you would win. Okay? Even though you're not from the ruling family or the ruling tribe or race. Okay? So, and because of this, and Allah knows best, these countries stay in power. They stay in power. When the justice breaks down in these countries, the power goes. And that's what we're witnessing now, that has been so clear over the past year. It's already been there, but now things have, the injustice is so bold-faced. It is so clear what is going on, that this is really, historically, it is the end of the society. And if you look at the Romans, they're probably the closest example. And the power, the irresistible power that the Roman Empire had. Nobody had a military like them. Nobody had economic power like the Romans. Okay, and you're going to defeat the Romans? You're not going to be able to defeat the Romans. That's what everybody thought. But then injustice coming. And then you see slavery and coliseums and people being fed to the lions and all types of things going on. And then the economy falls apart. The people turn against each other. And even the great Roman armies start fighting amongst themselves. And then the people who they oppress start attacking them. And they fall apart. This is probably the best example as to what we're witnessing happening right in front of us. Omar was so relentless in his pursuit for justice. He wanted to separate al-haq min al-batil, truth from falsehood. Right? He wanted to separate. To the point where they gave him the name al-Faruq, that he was the one who could separate, he separated truth from falsehood. He distinguished right from wrong. So everybody's got this laqab name that they have in Umar, Umar al-Faruq. This is what he is known as. He separates right from wrong. Okay? And this may be one of the strongest qualities that he had in terms of governance, how he actually governed the society. And so Umar had this strong ability, and he took it to another stage. Because when he ruled, he didn't just rule surface-wise. He would actually believe, he would actually rule based on not just the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. And that's missing many times in some so-called Muslim societies when Muslims practice partial Islam. And and we see it even in some of our own communities here, where people that read the hadith book and whatever, and they want to practice it in the masjid, right? But they don't have an Islamic society. They're not practicing. They don't know the spirit of the law. Because behind the laws themselves, there's actually a spirit that is there. Okay, so this is how Umar would rule. And he believed that it was given to him as a trust, amana. So it's a trust that he must implement what he thinks and what he believes and what he understands, especially for the poor people. And he was harsh on himself, right? And he cared. And one of his famous statements that he made showing his policy, because Islam is spreading now, right? And he said, if a dog were to die of hunger by the banks of the Euphrates, that's Iraq, I would feel myself responsible for it in front of Allah. A dog in Iraq, and Umar's in Medina, right, is suffering. Umar said, I'm responsible. Look at that leadership. Okay, that's another level. Okay, and that's an ideal that you know we are shooting for in our type of leadership. Okay, and again, this is your power and your strength, which is integrated with scholarship, and it takes the form of Islamic governance. And you know, the question comes up, and this question even in one of our classes has come up again, that there are some scholars that say Islam is not politics. It's not politics. So how can you know, the real Muslims don't enter politics. Okay, so how do you get this? These are the best people. This is the best generation. So Islam enters all aspects of life. Now, if you talk about politics, the way we use the term today, it's like polytricks, right? And if somebody said to you, if your friend said, I am going to become a politician, you'd probably look at your friend strange. Politician, that means you're going to lie. A politician tells you one thing before the elections, and after the election, he does something else. Okay, so politician is a dirty word. So we don't mean it like that. We're talking about governance, the rules that govern our society, and the ability to put this into practice in the way that it should be put in. And in this, you can see the spirit of the law, and you know that there is one case that comes out, and that is that, you know, it's a simple case, but it shows Umar's level, that this wealthy person came, you know, and said, there's different reports about this, but when he comes with his servant and this poor person and said, this person stole, he stole from me. Some reports say a camel, he stole the camel, chop his hand off, right, Umar? You practice in Islam? Chop the man's hand off. Umar then investigated this servant, and why did you steal? And the man said, I stole because this man would not pay me properly. See the injustice? So if you go by the letter of the law, he stole. Okay? But the man said, I stole because he wouldn't pay me. Umar then turned to the master or the wealthy person, and he said, if he steals again, I'll chop your hand off. You see what Umar said? I'm going to chop your hand off if he steals again. Because the reason why he was stealing is not because the lust or some evil thing. It's necessity. It's injustice. You see? That's the spirit of the law. And there are some people, and you even find this in Islamic movement, they quickly learn fiqh, they quickly learn things, but they don't have the spirit of Islam. And so they come off too harsh. They don't have the love inside of them when they are teaching some of the fiqh principles. Although if you put them on paper, they may say, well, I am following, you know the way, the true Islam. But when you see their practice, no love, there's no balance, the spirit is not there. Umar had this spirit. And so with this ability, Umar then established a judicial system. So he's taken this to another level now. So it's not only just law being applied, he actually established courts, and he trained people to be qadi. So the qadi is the judge. So there were certain people who had qualities, judging abilities. Umar put them into position as the qadis. He sent people to Damascus, sahabas to Basra and Kufa, to Cairo, to different areas, then to Yemen, to different places. He sent the people who were the highest trained to the different centers of Islam to actually implement this. So these qadis, you know, were on the level now. They're like mujtahids, because the qadi can now make rulings independent of the capital city. So that qadi now understands fiqh, understands the society, and can make judgment. And so as a society, what Umar did was, instead of taking the wealth and just building things and having nice clothes, he organized the administration. So he paid the qadis. He established a system of payments, right? And he monitored them. He monitored them to see what they were actually doing. See, so this is something different here now. Totally different. Okay? And so this brings the spirit of Islam on that level. Another important aspect of his rule was a type of public welfare system. The word welfare sometimes gives you the wrong understanding. It's like food stamps, so you're going to get something free for nothing. No. What it means is Islam is not capitalism, which is just individual property and, you know, like that, private ownership. And it's not communism. So communism or socialism is everybody owns the wealth together. No private property. Okay, no. Islam allows private property, but it will not allow anybody to monopolize. You see? So we're a system, not capitalism and not socialism. This is an important point for those of you who are studying high-level Islamic or high-level politics or political thought. Okay, we're on a different level. And one of the five pillars of Islam is zakat. So a certain amount of the wealth of every Muslim who has a certain amount will be taken, given to the poor, and if he can't find somebody, it goes to the Bayt al-Mal. That is the treasury house. So we would have a treasury house in some countries. It is called Oqaf, the Oqaf, Wazarat al-Oqaf, and that is Waqaf. So your trusts are put there. And from the Oqaf, people now can apply to that. The society is understood. The poor, the orphans, the widows, the travelers. You know, the Oqaf is many different things, whether it's your roads, your bridges. The Oqaf would even train people to be calling the Adhan. The Oqaf would also train ulama. You see, our leadership, it would have leadership schools. This is a key point, because economy is the basis of a society. It's like your lifeblood, right? And we have a natural lifeblood. If all the zakat, if Muslims paid zakat and put it in a treasury house, we would be one of the most powerful societies in the world. And you don't have to force people to give, like the socialists do. Okay, you don't have greedy people who, you know, control most of the wealth and brag and everything like that, and the other people are poor living below them. No. So this system he set up in a practical sense. Okay, so he set the pace for Islamic governments in the future. This is what Umar was doing. So this is why he is one of the chief examples of this system. And Umar was a broad thinker. He was a wide thinker. He even thought about the mentality of Muslims. Do we follow the solar calendar, the Persian calendar? Because these calendars are based on fire worshippers, sun worshippers. He said, we need to establish our own calendar. So he sat together with the leading scholars. One year after the Hijrah, that's when our society really came together and started. So that's our Hijri calendar, which is a very important thing, Because if you think in terms of the Hijri calendar, your mind is not controlled by the other calendar. Many of us, we got one foot on both sides. We're living here. So you have a Thanksgiving's coming. Okay? And there's no problem. You get a halal turkey, right? It's okay. Get a halal turkey. Put some curry in it too, whatever you want. But reality is, we're not governed by Thanksgiving, right? Because for the native people here in this part of the world, especially in the United States, Thanksgiving, you know, and Columbus Day, and all of these are actually days of sorrow, sadness, okay? Christmas is actually a time of solar winter solstice, right? Pagan worshippers. Easter in the spring, pagan worshippers. June is the time of immorality, the summer solstice. And now you see what June is now here, right? That's historically what it was. Aphrodite, Venus, uncontrolled immorality, June. Fall, that we're going into now, becomes not only Thanksgiving, but also Halloween, where the Shaitan comes up. So if we're controlled, if our year is based on these things, your mind is colonized. You get it? So when Umar was doing this, he's freeing the minds of the Muslims. He's literally freeing our minds. This is a broad thinking person, you know, and that is the type of leadership that we want. And so he set up a government. He set up a military. He even had jails, taxation, you know, regions ruling, whatever. This was a society he set. Okay, and this is an important base that actually we're still benefiting from up until today. Okay, so by enforcing this and Islam spreading now, and you know what Umar also did? Very interesting. He developed what the Americans called in the West Pony Express. The Pony Express is when you want to send a letter and then you have a rider who rides. This is before communication, mass communication. So the rider takes your pass, your mail, and then takes it to an outpost, gives it to the next rider, he takes it to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. Umar set that up before the American cowboys. Okay? And they were able to revolutionize communications. So horses, riders are moving constantly around the Muslim world. Information is moving constantly around the Muslim world. That's what happens when you have a leader who's a scholar too. See? And because of this, it is estimated that the empire under him was actually the second largest empire on earth at the time. Romans had fallen for the most part. Persians had fallen for the most part. Ethiopians were strong, but they were within their lands. Chinese was the only other major one. So Muslims then became the second largest empire in the world. And one of the beauties about Umar is that he loved education. And he was really into scholarship. And so education became widespread, especially the Quran itself. The teachings became widespread. And he took a position not to force people to accept Islam. That non-Muslims could live within an Islamic society. Now, this is contrary to what people will say, you Islamists. Okay, contrary. Non-Muslims could live within an Islamic society. And when they see Muslims rising, they see the belief in God, they see morality, then they'll accept Islam. That's what happened. That's why millions of people embraced Islam. Okay? So some of the key lessons in conclusion is that his justice had mercy in it. He didn't just rule by the letter of the law, but he ruled with the spirit of the law, which is compassion. It is not to harm people and hurt people, but it's to establish justice. Also, that he was dealing with social issues, social needs of people. It's a holistic rule of government, not just political, but it's dealing with social life. It's dealing with the root causes of problems within Islamic society. Next is that Omar himself, he was personally accountable. He was accountable himself. And he was harsh on himself as a leader. And that's the ideal position to be in. And that's a reminder for the leaders in the so-called Muslim today. So this is Umar ibn Khattab, one of the key points of the fusion of scholarship and leader. A great example of this: fairness, justice, and strength. This is what we pray for. It doesn't come overnight. We have to train our youth, our families, our future toward this type of fusion scholarship. And we will continue on, inshallah, to look. But before we come to a conclusion, I want to open up the floor for any questions that anybody may have concerning Umar ibn Khattab. So this is your fusion now, right? Fusion leadership between the leader and the scholar. Floor is open.
Okay, first question. Honoring over the chosen of leadership in Islamic Sharia, voting of leadership by the masses or leadership succession by royal family, which one is close to Islam?
So the leadership of, I didn't hear the beginning what you said. Okay.
In Islamic Sharia, so is it voting of leadership or leadership succession by royal family? Which
one is voting?
Yes, so
is it voting or is it royal family?
Yeah, which one is closer to Islam?
Okay. Number one, these are not the only two ways of choosing your leader. So ours is different. You know, ours is a meritocracy. It is the person who is deserving of the leadership. You know, and we would have a selection committee, Ahlul Hal wal Aqad. These are the people who literally tie knots and open knots. That means they solve problems. So that's your leadership council taken from different levels in society. Okay? And then it's like a selection committee. People put forward names, and then you would have people who would, it's ratifying it. So the masses of the people would ratify a choice that is made, okay? And so that would be closer to voting, but I don't want to get it mixed up with this so-called democracy of today. Because if you look at places like America, which is the harshest example, it's not really democracy because, you know, you can't run for president unless you have millions of dollars. It's only the rich and the famous who can even be strong enough. So it's not based on your merit. It's based upon wealth and based upon power. So that's not really a democracy. So the closest would be a type of voting, but it's not really voting in a so-called democracy like you see today. It is a selection of the person who is the most suitable, a meritocracy. Okay? That is the one who would be the leader in Islam. So the people do have a say. If the people rise up and say, we don't want this person as the leader, then the selection committee has to listen to the people. So it's not a tyranny. Yeah.
To build on that question, you know, there's this debate that I've seen a lot about people asking whether Muslims should vote or should not vote in the democracy that we live in. And some people have even said that it's haram, but I just want to tie like my thinking, and you let me know if I'm off base here, but you know, I'm thinking that as a Muslim, when our priority is that when we live in a society, even if it's not our society, and we want to achieve leadership, we have to participate in society. And
right.
When we see right is going right, we support it. If something is going wrong, we do our best within our power to stop it.
Yeah.
So when even though the democracy that we live in is so rigged, and that so there's truly so few differences between the politicians that are in power, isn't it still our responsibility? The way I see it is that it's still a responsibility as Muslims to participate in voting. But what do you think about that? And then the other question I have is, what if all of the politicians are horrible choices?
Okay, so this is a good question, and that's concerning voting. Is it permissible to vote or not, especially when, your leaders are, horrible choices? What's the responsibility of Muslims in this case? This is a complex issue, and it's based upon where you are. However, we do have a responsibility to get involved in our society. We're not supposed to be cut off from society. Because whether you like it or not, you are part of the society. And I remember there was a case in Chicago of this masjid, and the brothers are sitting around saying, haram to vote. The mayor, we're not going to vote for these kuffar. And it was said that they were in council at that point trying to decide whether to shut down the masjid or not. That's what they were discussing. And the brothers are saying it's haram to be involved in that. And they're about to shut you down. So the best thing would be is to get somebody on a local level who can represent you and support that person. And then they will go to that meeting and they will stand for your case. This is calling to for the bid amr bil maruf or nahy al munkar. It's calling to the good and forbidding evil. Okay, so on a lower level, you can say we should be involved. In our areas, we should have our representatives. We should be involved in whatever level that we possibly can to govern as much as we possibly can. There's even a city in Michigan, Hamtramck City, which is like majority Muslim. The mayor is a Muslim. There's majority Muslims in the city in Michigan. Okay, so we should on that level. Now, when you go to the higher level now, where you have huge political parties, both of them, are killing our people, then really, this is a very difficult situation, especially you could say what's happening in the United States now, where both sides are supporting, the genocide of Muslims. What do you actually do? The position that many scholars are taking now is the best thing to do is to vote for a third party. Find a third party, and in America you have third party groups. Okay, there's a number of them. So at least you can, if this third party can get strong enough, it can be an alternative.
Maybe the third party over here, so they came out straight out and said they're really supporting the Jews.
Yeah, so I'm saying here is a little bit more cloudy. But somehow we have to, those people who are hurting us, we have to punish them with our votes. That's the clearest thing. So this is why it's not, in each place, you have to have your leaders to be able to, we need to discuss this to see what is the best way to go.
Like for example, like I'm living in Binbi, right? And this, the council, she's now running for the conservative. She's a Muslim. She came to my place. I confronted her with his power.
Yeah.
2 days ago, she is with Peria by his side. So she didn't support his policy. She just came to get your votes and
right.
When I confront, So they are liars, as you said, probably. So what you can do in that situation right now?
Well, you don't have to vote, right?
No,
technically speaking, you don't have to vote. If your conscience is telling you don't vote. Some people say, oh, no, because this is before in America they used to say, is Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, whatever. They say, hold your nose and vote for Hillary because she smells, right? But not as smell as bad as Trump. So are you voting for Lucifer or Satan? Like, they're both devils, right?
Or even a fourth option that I've heard is that, when you go to vote, there's an option where you go in to say, I'm coming in and I'm choosing to say that I choose not to vote, which shows that your ballot and your voice is still being accounted for, but it's showing that there's a certain amount of people within your own region that is so upset with the selection that they came just to say that I choose not to vote because I'm unhappy with all of the selection.
That's right. There is in America, I don't know whether we have that here, there is uncommitted. There is an uncommitted thing you can sign. We have uncommitted too. Okay, so because I don't vote at all, right? I don't even go near the place. But I'm saying for those who do, right, there is an uncommitted. Okay, so if you gotta vote for the uncommitted, you know, go by your conscience, you know, go for that. None of the scholars, I know, you know, they're trying to say that the scholars in America are saying vote for the Green Party, you know, because there is a Muslim, you know, who is there. Cornel West also has, you know, a Muslim under him as well, you know, but none of the scholars are saying, telling you who exactly to vote for. But they're saying, do something. Make ourselves to be known. Otherwise, we become like sheep. We're like sheep. We can be herded anyway. We have no strength. We have nothing.
And you know what's common in American, like within the American Muslims and the Canadian Muslims, within the American politics right now, is that there's a, they're, you know, because they're going from state to state right now trying to get like the Muslim population to vote for the different parties. So different like Muslim associations have started to show that they are endorsing certain parties, and that's what the politicians want. So there are different like Muslim parties in America that have endorsed the Green Party. So that's like you can count on at least like, you know, if IIT, for example, were to say we support XY politician, you can guarantee that a good amount of the people that are associated with IIT are going to endorse that population. And in Canada, we're going to see it at the next election as well, is that they do the politicians really do heavily rely on the Muslim vote to be counted as like the swing vote.
The swing vote.
So like it's been a part of their system, especially when it comes to the Liberal Party, is that their goal is to convince everybody not to waste your vote, and I say waste in quotations, not to waste your vote essentially on a third or uncommitted vote, because they try to scare us by saying, well, if you don't vote for us, it's kind of like the Hillary and Trump versus situation.
Right.
Well, you know, Pierre Poilievre is going to win. And you guys want a conservative party to be in power over a liberal party, even though you're not happy with us. You're going to be even more unhappy with the other party. Like, essentially trying to scare everybody to vote for them, when if we were to stand united as Muslims and to show that irregardless, we're so unhappy with your policies that we're going to vote for a third party regardless, knowing that we may be hurt for the next 4 years.
That's right.
That we're uncommitted for the next 4 years, and just depend on our communities as Muslims to take care of one another, then they would be forced to change their policies. Liberals wouldn't be, like, you know, supporting the businesses that still send like warfare to Israel to kill Palestinians.
Yeah, so I mean, this is a good comment, you know, in that, you know, here in Canada, some years ago, idealists. We have to have the way forward. You have to have the solutions in order to deal with the problems of today. Okay? So we're going to close the class there.
There's more questions.
Okay, another question? Yeah. Yes, so inshallah, you know, in one of the upcoming sessions, we will be dealing with Umar, the Khalifa Umar ibn Abdulaziz, radiallahu, because he is considered to be, you know, one of the great, you know, Khalifas. He will be one that we will take. It's coming. So, you know, that's another fusion, one that came later on after this Khulafa Rashidin. But in between him, you're going to see some other things that happened. So he is another good example. Of a leader who combined both, Umar ibn Abdulaziz. Okay, and we'll bring you some sources and things when we come there. Any other questions anybody has?
So do we treat our followers with dignity and respect? And how do we treat the masses when they do not want to follow?
Yeah, you know, is the Islamic way, you know, we have to treat people with respect. And with dignity. That is the Islamic way, and to keep calling to the truth. Because many times the problem with the masses is ignorance. They don't know. So if they don't have the right information, somebody's got to get the right information to them. And we have to continue, you know, until consciousness, you know, rises, you know, amongst the masses of the Muslims. Allah is the best to guide. One good thing about Muslims is we do things as a group. Ramadan is a good example. So if the right trend is going, then you'll see Muslims fast get on. That's our nature. You're going to see Muslims all over the world. It's just a matter of having that trend to be set, you know, and a good direction to go in. And then inshallah, with the help of Allah, you know, we will see great change. So inshallah, we will continue on next week. Showing these examples and praying that Allah would rise up leadership amongst the Muslim world, especially at this very critical point in our history. أقول قولي هذا واستغفر الله لي ولكم وآخر دعوانا الحمد لله رب العالمين والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.